go for launch.
Five.
Quiet, numbskulls. I'm broadcasting.
Anything can happen in the next half hour.
Four.
My friend, we cannot keep this a secret any longer.
This whole thing is insane.
Three.
Quiet, please. I am analyzing.
Where's the kaboom?
Two.
There was supposed to be an earth-shattering kaboom.
One.
Greetings, my fellow galactic travelers, and welcome back to Planet 8. This is your mission commander, Larry, speaking to you from our hidden base. Chief Engineer Bob is here by my side as always in the command center, and circling Planet 8 in our orbital spy satellite is Reconnaissance Officer Karen.
And on this episode, we're not sure what the title's going to be, but we're going to be talking about Ray Harryhausen, his first four films. The King of Dynamation. Straight away, let's kick it over to Bob. Chief, take it away.
Well, sort of the idea behind this one was just to cover Ray Harryhausen's black and white films, those first four films that kind of launched his career, got him on his way. Yes, he did Puppetoons. Yes, he worked on Mighty Joe Young, but these were his movies. When he was responsible for the technical effects, as they're called in the credits. So we're going to be covering Beast from 20,000 Fathoms. It Came from Beneath the Sea. Earth versus the Flying Saucers. And 20 Million Miles to Earth. So we're going to cover those four, and then we'll kind of, at the end, we'll let everybody know what our favorites were in there. Or our favorite. So I guess we'll kick it off with the first one, which was Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, which was 1953, I believe.
Yep.
And yeah, it had sort of an interesting start because Ray basically wrote a story, and then his buddy, Ray Bradbury, at the same time, had a story in the New York Post that was called, went by a couple different names.
Yeah.
The Foghorn was one. I think Beast from the Sea, I believe, was another. And then
it also had this title, right?
Some Fathoms. So even though, I mean, have you guys read that story?
No.
No.
Basically, it completely centers around this sea monster who comes to shore, and it takes place from the viewpoint of a guy in a lighthouse. And it's the foghorn of the lighthouse that, like, calls out to the sea beast, brings it out to basically, I don't know, mate with the lighthouse or...
Oh my.
So eventually he ends up destroying the lighthouse, but that was only one small scene in Harryhausen's story.
Right.
But because it was there, he talked the studio into buying the story from Ray Bradbury. And so that's why I believe in the credits it says, inspired by the story from the New York Post.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when they bought it, then it was named the same as the movie, so it could be a big tie-in and everything else. But it was really just that one little scene from the movie that was the basis of the entire story. But it was enough to make Ray Bradbury some money. So
yeah,
I'm sure he was happy. But yeah, that started a long time friendship, basically, between Ray Bradbury, Ray Harryhausen, and Forrest J. Ackerman. The three of them would get together all the time. So going back to Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, it started now. Maybe one of you guys know what studio it started at?
I do not know which studio it started at.
Sorry,
I kind of know what prompted it.
By Warner Brothers. And The interesting thing was it was actually completed under the first studio and had a completely different soundtrack. Huh. And when it went over to Warner Brothers, they wiped that soundtrack and did one of their own.
Hmm.
So, yeah, I mean, I'd like to hear, you know, I think David Schechter would be the guy to talk to, but I wouldn't mind hearing what that original soundtrack sounded like.
Yeah, I wonder who did it. That'd be interesting.
I could probably Google it up, but yeah, it was definitely, that's the way it is. So, basically, you know, grew up watching the movie. I used to play on Channel 44 here on the Mount Monster Movie Matinee. And yeah, it did. It was made for like $200,000. And before it even got released, when Warner Brothers bought it, they bought it for $600,000. So it made money before it even hit theaters. And then fairly well in the theaters. But where did you guys see it on? I'm sure you probably saw it on TV.
Oh, yeah.
None of us are old enough to have seen a movie in the theaters in 1953.
Oh, no.
No. I don't think Will ever showed it in Thrillville, but a lot of, you know, Ray's stuff, along with all the other Flotsam and Jetsam, Will could get a hold of. He'd put on the big screen, and that was, said it many times before, part of the joy and fun of Thrillville is watching stuff that, you know, you'd normally watch on TV. But for me, Beast was TV. And, you know, in rewatching this stuff, it still holds up. I know I say that a lot too, but Ray's work is just timeless. It just looked real and felt real. And as a kid, your imagination is suspended. And, you know, here's this behemoth walking through town, eating people and cars and, you know, all that good stuff. It was a great, great movie, popcorn movie. I really enjoyed myself.
I mean, the movie basically gave birth to other films. I mean, it was basically the first film that dealt with radioactivity,
mm-hmm.
something that raised the creature or the beast. And also in the original storyboards, he breathed fire, but they felt they didn't have the budget to do that. But in some of the publicity posters, they showed him breathing fire. And it was definitely, it was an inspiration for Godzilla, started that. But it was also started all the other films in the 50s, whether it be Them or whatever, that where creatures were created from radioactivity or atomic bombs or what have you. In fact, Eugene Laurie, who directed Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, went on to do Giant Behemoth as well as Gorgo. So if you want to have a giant monster triple feature, then you could just go the Eugene Laurie route and do those three films.
I think it's, what's interesting is it is sandwiched, you could say it's sandwiched sort of in between Godzilla and King Kong, because King Kong had been re-released the year before, you know, Beast came out, and it was a huge impetus for why Beast was made in the first place, because Kong came out and was a big success again. So it was like, oh, we, you know, maybe we could make these monster movies. But like you said, Bob, you know, they did the nuclear route, and that influenced all these other films afterwards.
See, I always wonder too, because this, the Beast was given birth or resurrected by radioactivity. And so how did they kill it? Spoiler alert, with a radioactive isotope. So it's like, here's a monster built, birthed by radioactivity, and we'll kill it by shooting it with radioactivity.
Well, it was kind of weird because it had a disease. It had that open wound, and it had some sort of disease which was infecting the soldiers, and they were all like passing out, and they're like, well, we can, you know, kill that disease with the isotope. At least that was what I was getting out of it. But then it also seemed to sort of be saying, well, we'll be able to kill the monster too by shooting it with the isotope. So I don't know. It was a little like, okay, which is it? Are you killing the disease? Are you killing the monster? Does it somehow kill both at the same time?
Get Lee Van Cleef into the movie.
And yeah, I got Lee Van Cleef as the hitman.
That's interesting. What you're saying, Walker, because, you know, low doses of radiation can treat like a form of cancer. But a high dose of radiation, you go to get an x-ray and they always put that lead, you know, vest on you. And it's like,
does that really do anything? Because as soon as they put the lead vest on, they get out of the room quick.
So, you know, the beast was resurrected by, you know, this amount of radioactive energy. And, yeah, we're going to destroy it, you know, with this. So,
maybe we should pass the limit. And then,
I don't know that we need to question the physics involved here.
If we could talk about giant ants' legs.
Okay, don't get started with that. That's mathematics and well, physics too.
See, the Rhetosaurus, yeah, he's got the big trunk legs like an elephant. So
he's fine. He'll do fine. It's an interesting. I like the design of the creature in this. I know some people. So I did take a look at Bill Warren's the late Bill Warren's great book, Keep Watching the Skies, and he wasn't. Although he liked the film, he wasn't super kind about the design of the creature.
Really?
Surprisingly.
Classic design. I love
it. Yeah. I mean, it's a great dinosaur design. I enjoyed watching it. I think it's interesting to look at this and realize, like, this is Harryhausen's first solo outing. And he really imbues, and this is something that will become, like, such a characteristic of his work, is that he imbues that dinosaur with personality, right? You see it, you know, it's kind of looking around and moving and all the little intricacies of its character as it moves around and, you know, tries to either attack things or escape from things. I thought it was a great design.
Chomp on a policeman.
Yes, that famous.
Yeah, I was reading about how that was done, and Ray was saying that it was an actual actor, obviously, standing on the street there, and they put him on, like, a hoist. And so what they did was they hoisted him up through and out of the shot, and then he superimposed the Rhetosaurus's head into the shot, so it looked like it was in his mouth. And then once they take the shot of the direct front view of the Rhetosaurus, then it's a little animated guy with the legs going. But in order to not have to animate a complete figure, they just used an actor. And then when all it was showing was his legs, then he just animated those. But
there was an interview, or maybe it was a behind the scenes, or not behind the scenes, but the...
Like a special on the
what's it called when they talk over the movie?
Oh, commentary.
Commentary with Harryhausen. And he was basically saying, look, a lot of this we made up as we're doing. There were other things that were happy mistakes. And then there were actual plans to save money because we only had, you know, $100,000, $200,000. The studio wasn't going to give us any more money. And the guys that were with him were like, something like that'd be like $200 million nowadays. And he's like, not back then.
Well, that's the thing too, because if you look, he did actually, you know, you always think of Ray Harryhausen as stop motion, but he did actually make a puppet of the Rhetosaur, which in interviews he refers to as the sock puppet. But when you see the Rhetosaur through the window of the bathysphere. That's the puppet.
Oh.
And then they used it in a couple other shots similar to that. So I guess in maybe three shots in the whole film, but I think they use the puppet when it comes along and opens its mouth and swallows up the shark and the octopus.
Okay.
Hmm.
And then there's one other shot that I don't quite remember, but Yeah, so it'd be cool just to find that puppet somewhere. It's probably all decayed and cracked. And
depending on Ryan, if it was latex or, yeah. You know, there was another interview and he was saying, they're like, well, how did you make, you know, the figure? And I take it home and bake it in the oven, you know, in between dinner. And
well,
you know, my father helped me.
It was actually his father that made all the armatures, all the basically the metal skeletons inside the creatures. And was just basically like pieces of metal with ball joints. And he'd do the skeletal structure. And then Ray would come in and basically put like cotton over it and then latex over that. And yeah, I mean, this is amazing. Some of the things that they were able to come up with, and the detail, all the detail on the creatures and stuff.
What's sad is that they'd butcher, you know, they're done with the movie and they butcher this figure to create the Cyclops for the next movie. Yeah. And then butcher
the Beast was made into the dragon from 7 Foot.
Yeah,
I can see that.
It's sad, but you know, that's how they did it back then.
Yeah. Well, they didn't have a reverence for the, they didn't know these films were going to go on to be talked about for 56 years.
I saw the Brontosaurus from King Kong at Forrest J. Ackerman's place. And that thing was in, I mean, Bob Burns took Kong and Mighty Joe Young and basically stripped off all the latex and everything that was falling apart. So he just has like the armatures.
Yeah.
But Forrest didn't really do that. He had the Brontosaurus and it was still there. All just, you could see a lot of the armature through it, because it was just cracked and decayed and falling apart and dried out. And yeah, it was just, it's sad. I mean, you know, these are like classic creatures and you see the disrepair they've gone into, but
they weren't necessarily meant to last forever. So,
but overall a great film, fun to watch, interesting, great effects. And the humans were okay in this movie, too.
They were okay. Ever wanted to go down in a bathysphere?
I don't think I'll be submerging myself anytime soon. Especially after, oh, gosh, what was the submarine a couple of years ago that
imploded?
Oh, that just got caught.
Yeah.
I can live without it. I think it's interesting, though, like watching all four of these in not succession, but pretty close to each other. The whole formula with on the human side of the equation with, you know, the sort of this pseudo romance. There's the male figure is either a military guy or scientist, some sort of authority. And the woman is like sort of has to be there. So she's either like a scientist or secretary or whatever. And I mean, it's very, very formulaic. So that part of it, like when you watch them one after the other, you're kind of like, this is the same damn story. But of course, we don't watch these for that part of the story.
Look at the women. This is kind of getting ahead of ourselves. But the main actress in It Came From Beneath the Sea, she was a professor and a scientist. So she was actually doing research and helping figure out what the creature is. And then in 20 million Miles to Earth, she's almost a doctor.
Almost a doctor.
Yes, almost a doctor.
That's good enough.
So, yeah, I mean, they're not just your typical damsels in distress or, you know, wannabe housewives or whatever. I mean, and that was kind of, I think, kind of advanced for films of that time.
It was better than most, I guess you could say.
Is there a doctor in the house?
They had to have a reason for having them there. And I guess they couldn't always just be a secretary or a wife or something. So I think coming up with like, oh, wow, she's actually a marine biologist, or, oh, she's a doctor almost. Makes it a little more interesting.
Be bold, cast Granny from the Beverly Hillbillies.
Well, shall we move on to
I think we should.
Who would like to start, kick off the next film?
Walker.
Well, I will say, so our next film is It Came From Beneath the Sea from 1955. And this is about a giant irradiated octopus that gets a little out of control and gets a little wacko and starts attacking. First it attacks a submarine, and then it decides it wants to go visit San Francisco, and it starts attacking the Bay Area.
It's like it hit like Washington, Oregon on the way down, and then finally got to San Francisco.
Well, if it did hit those other places, it didn't make an impression on me. So maybe it did. The big payoff is like the Golden Gate Bridge. It also goes, I think, to the port, and it's got that one tentacle that's reaching in and down the street. I will say that the remarkable thing about this, I think, well, there's maybe several, but it's his Harryhausen's first film with Charles Schneer, who will go on to become his partner in all his endeavors after this. And so this is important in that they developed this relationship where he's producing and Harryhausen is doing the effects. So this is an important relationship that develops here. And apparently based on some of the stuff I read, Schneer was one of the people saying, oh, we should do an octopus. An octopus would be really exciting. Oh, so that maybe he may have contributed the idea for that. There's some familiar players in this. Kenneth Tobey plays the submarine captain, well known to fans of the genre as being the Air Force captain, I believe, or maybe it's Army Air Force, I don't know, in The Thing. So he was the lead there. And then, and I'm not sure how to pronounce her last name, Faith Domergue? Domergue?
Domergue, I think.
Sounds about right.
So she was also in this Island Earth. So, and maybe a few other things, I don't know, but I know for sure this Island Earth. So both of these leading stars have some genre credits here. And very, you know, when you see them, you're like, oh, yeah, I know them. I've seen them before. This is, you know, this is the octopus movie, I think. And, of course, I think everybody knows that Harryhausen, due to, like, budget limitations and time limitations, only put 6 tentacles on the octopus instead of 8. So
he called it the sixtopus.
Yeah.
But if you think about it, you know, when he's coming out of the water, you know, you only see whatever tentacles are reaching out of the water. You don't see,
right.
And no, unless they did like a aerial view of him, you wouldn't see all 8 tentacles. So 6, 8 doesn't matter. You know, the way that it's shot and the way that, the camera angles are on the octopus, it's you'll never know.
Yeah, I think he was more concerned about it than anybody else.
And then he did just one big tentacle.
Yeah.
Which he used to basically do the ferry building and go down Market Street or whatever street he was going down. But it was funny because Ed Gazdzieski, who has written numerous books on Godzilla and all the different Japanese films, audio commentaries, everything, he would come into town and I'd always take him to a Giants game. So we were driving down Market Street to get to the ballpark. And right at the end, you can see the big clock tower. The ferry building.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've driven down there a lot of times. I don't give it half a thought, but as soon as we got to that point, he's like, that's from, it came from beneath the sea. And it's like, oh yeah, yes, it is. You know, but, but yeah, he was totally amazed. Oh, look. So,
I had read that there were, you know, rumors that sometimes certain directors felt that Harryhausen overstepped or tried to direct the film, because he'd go out there and he'd be like, well, you know, the thing's going to, you know, attack this and kind of look like, you know, and it, what Harryhausen said, it was meant to be a collaboration. Look, I'm filming this stuff and this is how it's going to look. And so this is the angle I would recommend so that, you know, the film fits together nicely and people don't mm-hmm. see, you know, the left side of the bridge and then the right side of the bridge. It makes sense.
Yeah. The other problem was they were shooting around San Francisco and they could not get a permit to shoot on the Golden Gate Bridge.
Yeah. Mm.
So they ended up putting a camera on the back of a bakery truck and just drove back and forth over the bridge like half a dozen times, getting whatever shots they needed as they drove. And then they got everything that they had to get. But yeah, they had to do a little sneaky.
Surreptitious filmmaking.
Oh. Guerrilla filmmaking.
Yeah, at its best.
So, yeah, anything to get a film done. But, yeah, no, it's a cool film. They're definitely, even though it's just an octopus, he's got some great scenes in there. I don't know what it looks like underwater behind the ferry building, but he's got shots down there. I don't know if they went down to check it out or they just said, well, it must look like this.
Yeah, I thought it was really cool.
Water behind the ferry building and see what it looks like.
It's really cool to see the ferry building. How much has it changed then to now? And, you know, the streets of San Francisco, you know, then and now. So that was fun for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, San Francisco has a lot of older architecture and things. So there are still some buildings in there that haven't changed since back then that have been around. Yeah. Since before that, so.
Well, you know, they didn't show it, but like the expressway that went down in the Loma Prieta, you know, after the Loma Prieta earthquake, like changed a lot of the city, you know. Yeah. But again, not in this film. Anywho, how many films have you seen that have a giant octopus terrorizing a town? I mean, I know this is, it has to be the first and probably the best for my book.
I've seen a lot of movies with octopuses, giant octopuses in them, but octopi, I guess.
But I've seen maybe two or three, but you know.
I don't know if I can think of another one that stars a giant octopus.
Well, not stars, but I mean, you know, look at War of the Gargantuas, the Green Gargantua.
Oh, well, yeah, yeah. But it's not the main thing in it.
Yeah.
On the island at Kong fights and things. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I'm just saying there's, and you've also got like, it was an octopus or squid in 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Oh.
I think it was a squid.
Axonotlus. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of movies with squids and octopi and things, but.
In my thinking, this octopus took the place of like Godzilla or Kong in one of their movies, you know, there other things and, you know, roles, but this was like the focus, you know, and it only had six tentacles. So kids, don't let people tell you can't do something.
I will say
don't
that
let people tell you, you can't take shortcuts if you need to.
That's right.
The human story in this one is perhaps the most boring human story. There's a lot of exposition.
There was a human story in this one. I missed it.
There you go. It was at times very hard to pay attention. there's a lot of exposition, like pseudo documentary, and then a very like half-assed love triangle. So
they all become buddies by the end.
It's weird. Yeah, it's very weird. I read that Kenneth Toby said that there was a whole love scene between him and Faith Domergue, yeah, and it got chopped out. So, yeah, if it feels half-assed, it's because it was, because they chopped the other half of the ass out. So, yeah, it was just that part is not even worth paying any attention to, really, except some of the submarine stuff is kind of cool. But
They shot at the Naval Shipyards in San Francisco, and they actually shot on an actual submarine.
Mm-hmm.
Money. So they actually, when they're inside the submarines, don't look at it and say, oh, that looks like a cheap set. No, that was an actual submarine.
Right. So that part was good. Just, yeah, a lot of the expositionary stuff and the anything between the men and the women is just like, forget it. It's lame. My opinion. I realize it's my opinion.
I happen to agree with that opinion, Walker.
There you go.
So I guess that leads us to
Earth. The flying saucer.
Earth versus the flying saucer.
Earth's attention.
Earth versus the flying saucers, also known as Invasion of the Flying Saucers and Flying Saucers from Outer Space, a 1956 Harryhausen film with his good pal, Mr. Schnurr. The story was suggested by the best-selling 1953 nonfiction book, Flying Saucers from Outer Space, mm-hmm. by Maj.
Sometimes we Commander
sleep deprived, so forgive me. Major Donald Kehoe. The film was released as a double feature with The Werewolf.
That is such an odd combination to me.
Did you see this one at the theater or the drive-in?
No, not me, man.
Okay. Oh, he would have been little still.
His parents could have, you know.
Come on, I'm not that old.
What was really weird for me is scientist Dr. Russell Marvin and his new bride, Carol, they're driving, and this huge freaking flying saucer like appears right on their tail. You see it in the back of their car. And they're like, whoa, the car. And, you know, apparently these saucers are going to invade our Earth. I think there was an article in Variety or someone reviewed the film and said, yeah, the film was okay. The star of the film was the flying saucers. And by God, let me tell you, those flying saucers, how do you animate and give intent and emotion to a dragon or an octopus? Good question. How do you do that with a flying saucer?
Mm-hmm.
And Ray does it. And, you know, the sound that when it takes off and when it's in trouble, like, woo.
Yeah.
The aliens look really meh.
He was not happy with the aliens.
Yeah, I was going to say. And, you know, it was out of his control.
Yeah, it was a budget thing. He had wanted to animate them. They didn't have the budget.
And the time. A lot of it had to do with time and budget. Because, you know, Ray says, look, 2 or 3 minutes of film could take him weeks.
Yeah.
Depending on what he's animating.
And he's doing it all by himself. Again, all these films, yes, he has help from different people to put the creatures together, but he's painstakingly filming, you know, frame by frame. It's just him.
He was even talking about the saucers. And if you watch, it's like the top part of the saucer rotates one way. The bottom rotates the opposite direction.
Mm-hmm.
He said, you know, if he went to lunch or took a break or whatever, he'd have to remember which direction each one was going in so he didn't, like, suddenly reverse them, you know, in the middle of a shot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I read in an article, a different film, he may have used it on this film, but he came up with a system where he'd have, like, these little notes that he'd put so that when he ended the day, he'd go home asleep and come back and be able to remember, oh, this is, you know, going in the left direction. This is going to go forward. The eye's going to, excuse me. This was one of the films where I listened to the commentary and the guys were making remarks on, you know, how did you create the missile strikes? You know, and he's like, well, you know, I'd have to film like a squib going off. Then I'd overimpose or superimpose it over the film. And then, you know, have to film the sky. And they're like, well, how did you, you know, what was the moon? How did you, that was a black velvet. And we just drilled a hole in some plywood and shone a light. And it's like, right, here you are making this like movie and you're creating this stuff that many, many special effects people used in their films after this. You know, Bob Burns famously said there was no internet back then. So you either knew people who knew people or you'd find a zine that kind of talked about how this film was made or these techniques came up. The guy was giving Ray a hard time and he's like, oh, you know, you'd animate this stuff for, you know, however many hours. Then you'd wind up at the Brown Derby later that night. And Ray's like, I had to work in the morning. There was no Brown Derby. I went home, saw what, you know, pieces my father had baked in the oven and, you know, ate dinner and started the day anew.
Well, too, if you look at those shots, I mean, he would say that he'd do a pass through the camera and he would shoot something, but he would mask off part of it in black. And then he'd run the film through again with the other parts in black and another piece in that black area. So it was like, you can't just take a computer and, you know, throw it in or use layers of film. He had to use multiple exposures. He also did a lot of plates, like Willis O'Brien back in King Kong, where he'd have a back plate, a plate in the foreground, and then something, you know, animated in the center. And yeah, and a lot of that was just, I need to do this. I need to figure it out, you know, figure out how to do it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
The inventiveness of Harryhausen, I mean, even today, you know, with the limitations that he had upon him, is another reason that he's undoubtedly still one of the greatest special effects guys ever, you know, because now, like, you go to a movie now, I mean, we all know how long the movies are, but the credits, my God, if you look at the credits for the special effects, there's like, you know, 200, 300 people doing the special effects, right?
Yeah, like a dozen different effects houses.
Right.
And each one, they call them houses.
Or two effects, and then they put them all together. But yeah, and then each effects house has like 50, 60 people there working on this.
And they're focused on different things and all this. This is one man who was sitting there going, well, how am I going to do this? Yeah. And so he's just pounding away in his little work area, trying to figure out how to make it work, and the patience. And yeah, again, this film, it's funny. I really like this film, but I know it's not necessarily the best example of his work or characteristic maybe of his overall career, right? Because it doesn't feature creatures. It's not a typical Harryhausen film. But like, Larry, like you were saying, though, the care he gives to these flying saucers to sort of imbue them with characteristics, you know? So when they're flying, they're not just cruising around. They do, they go down and up and they bounce away from things. And they almost seem like living things in the way that they behave, you know? And then I was going to say, when we get to the later part of the film with like the destruction in Washington and the care he takes to like animate things falling, pieces of marble and stuff, it's just, it's, you know, out the roof. I mean, it's crazy.
You know, I never knew he used like wires to have the building pieces fall so he could control. Even that was Dynamation. I was like,
perfectionist.
Right. And very effective filmmaker. One of the cool things, though, is with the flying saucers going, you never see the aliens flying in the ship, but later films by other people always show, shit, whoa.
Well, if you look at the saucers, too, on the under part of the saucers, they're like three nodules beneath there. And that's actually where he attached the wires. And
see, that's cool.
To have them floating around and things. But yeah, I mean, even like there's the one part where the Washington Monument tips over.
Yeah.
And lands on the ground. And that was, you know, he could have just taken a model and just, you know, pushed it over or whatever and filmed it. But no, that was all stop motion as well.
The Paul Frees voice the aliens, and that was a whole distortion part of it. There's an episode totally not, well, it's kind of related to this, of the Flintstones, where there were these aliens that made robots, replicas of Fred. And Fred at first was like, oh, cool, you know, I can go bowling and this robot's going to go cook for Wilma. And the robots would say, Yabba, Dabba, Do, which to me, they didn't say it, but was a throwback to these aliens. Very cool, little subtle homage to this film. And like you said, Karen, you know, no creatures, no, you know, flying saucers, and the alien. And the aliens have this like force field, electrical like shield around their ship. And when they walk outside the ship, of all things, bullets kill them. Mm-hmm. So like, just wait till they leave their force field
in metal or something. And then,
It is. I'm like, okay, well, you know, they had to end the movie somehow.
I think they had a good story with this one. It was interesting. And like when they got on board the UFO, I mean, this was made at the height of like the UFO craze. You know, they, like you said, Larry, they looked at, you know, flying saucers from outer space. That book, I read that Ray Harryhausen actually met with George Adamski, who was one of the more famous UFO contactees.
Wow.
To kind of find out like his thoughts on the UFOs and all that. So they were doing their homework. And obviously, you know, this film influenced a lot of others. And I think one of my favorite scenes, and it's not a Harryhausen scene, but when they're on board the UFO and they're talking about, and I wrote this down, their infinitely indexed memory bank. And they've taken the memories of the female character's dad, who is a colonel. And, you know, it's in our infinitely indexed memory bank now. And we have all his memories and thoughts, and they show the brain inside the guy's head glowing. And, you know, it's that kind of stuff that I just love from these 50s sci-fi movies.
Oh, it's a wild scene, too, because at one point when they start fighting back, they just, there's the one woman's father, and then who was like an army general or whatever. And then there was another military guy that had been captured, and they just drop him out of the saucer.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Two guys just falling to the ground. And it's,
this to me was a great example of a science fiction movie. You know, there's always like an army presence or a government presence, but you know, they made a lot of this stuff up, and it's fiction. It's science fiction, and it works. You suspend your belief, you know, certain aspects of reality. So I think this still holds up today, even the story.
Well, it's a lot of fun, and it has certain things in common with War of the Worlds, too, which is interesting.
Definitely.
Well, let's go ahead and throw it back to Bob for our fourth and final of the big four, first four King Ray Harryhausen films. Bob, take it away.
Well, the fourth film is 20 Million Miles to Earth. And holds a special place in my heart because our very Bay Area Film Event's very first show was the Dynamation Celebration over in Alameda. And we showed 20 Million Miles to Earth and Seventh Voyage of Sinbad. So technically, 20 Million Miles to Earth is the first film we ever showed under Bay Area Film Events. And this one has one of my favorite creatures, the Ymir. Mm-hmm. Although they never refer to it as the Ymir in the movie. Much like they never called the beast from 20,000 Fathoms the Retosaur in the movie. But it's basically a rocket ship crash lands in Sicily on its way back from Venus. And there's only two survivors, one of whom dies in the hospital. And basically, there's also a gelatinous mass that Pepe finds and trades to a local scientist that so he could get 2 lira so he could buy a cowboy hat from the great country of Texas.
That's right.
Yeah, this is basically the creature, the Ymir, the alien, whatever you want to call it, hatches from this gelatinous mass and then due to our atmosphere grows at an alarming rate to become a giant monster who wrecks havoc and runs amok. But I think this one, if you want to talk about imbuing personality into a monster, into a creature, this one is probably the best example. Because when he breaks out of that egg mass, whatever you want to call it, and he comes out and he like rubs his eyes and he's like, this scientist's daughter comes in to the camper or whatever and turns the light on, and he immediately ducks his head and puts his arm over his eyes. So there's a lot of personality in this little
you see a lot of that, and it's like, oh, progression from Harryhausen.
When he hatches, he's about this big. He's not very big at all.
But one thing that I found interesting that I read in one of the books is that if you notice, when Ray Harryhausen does a bipedal creature, the creature's arms are basically held behind him as he walks. Like when we normally walk, we're swinging our arms back and forth, right? But his creatures, they hold their arms behind them so he doesn't have to animate the arms. True with the Ymir, it's true with the Cyclops, it's true with, you know, some of the other creatures that he animated. And, you know, I wasn't being lazy or anything. He only had so much of a budget. And so it's like, well, get those legs moving. But
and again, time, you know, it takes time to animate all that.
Arms and hands and fingers and all that. But,
you know, at first they think the creature's very cute. Oh, look, Pepe, where did you find this? Oh, you know, on the beach. Pepe, and, you know, the scientist wants to, you know, do experiments on it. So he pays Pepe the lira and Pepe gets his cowboy hat. And
well, the creature gets 2-3 feet tall and then he's in the cage and the scientist is going to take it off to Rome, to one of the institutes to look at. But
it breaks out of the cage
and eventually breaks out. But
I remember as a kid, the part that really, really upset me was killing the elephant.
Yeah.
And I was a big fan of Dumbo. And I'm like, you bastard.
You killed Dumbo.
Not again. Well,
Thank God he didn't show the scene with the dog. That was all in shadow. Because if he'd shown the Ymir killing the dog, I think I would have lost my mind as a kid. Even now, that would really bother me.
That's why they usually lose me when they kill the dog off. But
yeah,
it's
hard to keep.
Yeah, it's interesting because when you first see the elephant, it's a real elephant in a zoo. But because this elephant, if you look at this elephant when he's fighting the Ymir, that's a big elephant. So in order to make it look bigger, they got a really like short guy to be the zookeeper and stand next to it. So it would look like a much bigger elephant.
That's interesting, the tricks they pull, because I didn't really notice that when I watched the movie. And then I watched some of the special features and they pointed that out. And I looked at him again and I was like, son of a gun, that guy really is. Like, if you really look at him, it's like, yeah, he's a short little dude. But
yeah, I mean, he's not like a midget or a dwarf.
No.
No.
You know, normally proportioned. But yeah, he's just a little short guy.
Yeah. You know, just little ways that you can manipulate people's perceptions. That's right.
Ray wanted a vacation in Rome, so he set the film in Rome.
You got it.
Which is actually cool to see the monster, like, you know, taking his final stand on the Colosseum.
I had read they got into a lot of trouble because the pavement was not built to withstand the tracks of a tank.
Yeah.
And so when the tanks rolled into town, it damaged the road and they had to, like, you know, pay for it. Yeah. So
I didn't hear about that.
Guerrilla filmmaking. What tanks? We didn't. Hey, come on, guys. Let's go.
But, you know, when the Emir gets shot up there on the Colosseum and he has this big dramatic death scene and falls, and, you know, it was like, right. That was obviously definitely inspired by King Kong.
Mm-hmm.
He gets shot on the Empire State Building and falls off, but it's not quite as far of a fall, but he definitely hammed it up as he was going down.
Yeah, the throat clutching and other stuff that the, you know, tend to do. Yeah, the tail. I think I like the design a lot. I know I had read that his original conception was like a cyclops or a satyr, but I'm glad he went away from the mythological. And I mean, obviously, if you're going to do an alien, then you need something completely different. But yeah, I like the look of it. It's
well, and the way that Ray works, that eventually did become a cyclops.
Well, we know he did cyclops eventually. So,
but even when he's on like the giant laboratory table, and he's laying, see his stomach going up and down as he breathes. Yeah, his little details like that were pretty amazing.
Yeah. Well, and that's what makes, you know, Harryhausen an artist, right? I mean, he pays attention to those things.
And even when he wakes up on the table and he, just before he gets up, he like rolls over and has that sort of Burt Reynolds pose, or I'm dating myself as a play. He's like leaning on one arm with the other one draped over. Hey, look at me. But I think it was cool too when they dropped the electrified nets on him,
and the noise he made too. The scream was like, whoa.
Yeah, well, it was like they did like a staccato roar.
Yeah,
and then he's like just shaking, you know, violently underneath the nets. So definitely, overall, a very cool film. Ray did have to animate that dog a little bit. He also had to animate the guy who runs up behind the Emir and sticks him with a pitchfork in the back.
Bad idea.
Yeah.
That was just not a good idea at all. And then this is the thing that killed me. The guy stuck him with the pitchfork. And then, of course, the Emir grabbed him and started to maul him. And everybody's just going, ooh, wow, that's terrible. Nobody, like, tries to stop it. Nobody shoots him. Nobody. They're just like, ooh, watching the guy screaming. And
feel sorry for him.
Well, William Hopper, like, runs up with the shovel and, like,
yeah,
shovel a few times.
It takes a few beats, though, you know.
Before he leaps into action.
Yeah.
That dude was pretty messed up by then.
Unfortunately. Well, my friends, we've come to that part of the podcast where we pick our favorite of the four films. So, Bob, why don't you kick off? And or did you want us to name ours?
I think
first?
I had a spoiler alert early. about 20 million miles to Earth. But yeah, that's definitely my favorite of the four. I think it's just such a classic creature, and the personality that Ray imbued in it was just amazing. And, you know, the people parts, you know, William Hopper and Miss Almost a Doctor, that was all good. And, you know, taking place in a Sicilian fishing village, and you've got the fishermen and things there. Yeah, definitely. And of course, because it was the first movie that Bay Area Film Events ever showed, overall, that would be my pick for the favorite of the four.
You know, I'm going to agree. I like the flying saucers and the whole, oh, we're going to get you, watch out. But the animation of the Ymir, you know, the small model to the large model to then the Dynamation with the elephant and all that, just good movie. Even the rocket landing in the water, crashing. I mean, that thing was huge, and they're running around trying to get the survivors, and it was great. Holds up today. Said that a lot tonight, but it's true.
Well, I'm torn because I think my favorite one to watch is probably Earth versus the Flying Saucers. But I think 20 Million Miles to Earth is the best example of Harryhausen's work. And I do like it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So depending on how we're really defining the choice of best.
Well, it doesn't really have to be which one is better. It's like, which one resonates most with you?
Enjoying.
I think I probably enjoy Earth versus the Flying Saucers more, but I will say that I think if you want to see the best example of his work from the period, I would go with 20 Million Miles to Earth.
Yeah, if I had to pick a close second, it would probably be Beast from 20,000 Fathoms.
Flying Saucers would be mine. I really, it might have been my number one, but overall, the Italian, they really talk to me, so I enjoyed the film. This was a fun episode. I really enjoyed the research on this, as with all episodes. But it's nice to visit Ray's work. You know, I hadn't seen a lot of these films for some time, so this was a lot of fun for me to get back into.
If they want to hear about the whole background of Ray Harryhausen and all that, we did do a Ray Harryhausen episode earlier in the Planet. Maybe Karen can put the link in the show notes.
Yeah, I'll have to look that one up. That was many moons ago.
Many moons ago. No video.
Season one.
I don't even know if we did a YouTube video version of it. It might just be a video.
I don't think so.
I don't think so. I think it was back in like our first year. So,
with Butch Portillo.
Yeah.
Was he involved in that one?
Yeah. Okay. Three of us and Butch.
Okay. I will see if I can uncover the episode link.
Cool. Now, my friends, you need to comment either on our YouTube, Facebook, or Twitter page what was your favorite of those four films. So you have a little bit of homework yourselves, and share with us, you know, when did you see it? Why do you care or enjoy it more than the others? You may enjoy all four of them too. I mean, there's no right or wrong answer, but we'd be really, really glad to hear from you.
So. Maybe, just maybe, we could put a poll up on our Facebook page.
Mm, that would be fun.
Yeah. Advanced now. Technology.
Now, yes. Technology is good. Now, we do enter into our sensor sweep. Walker, why don't
you... Sensor sweep!
Show us what you have.
People attention.
It would be very unkind of us to do an entire episode in those voices.
Oh, that would be tempting.
They just turn us off. What, you know? I have this magnificent tome, Ray Harryhausen, An Animated Life.
That is a beautiful book.
It's a great book. I don't even remember how many years ago this came out, to be honest. But I know I scooped it up right away.
At Expressions Art College in Emeryville. And that had just come out. And so I do have the book, and it is autographed by Mr. Harryhausen.
Wow, that's an extra I don't have. It says first published in the United States in 2004.
Yeah.
So it's an oldie but a goodie. Great book. Lots of sketches from Harryhausen showing his concept work for the films, and then photos from the films. I have no idea. It's probably not in print anymore. But anyway, highly recommended if you can get your hands on it. Really great book with Harryhausen's thoughts and work.
Awesome. If you don't mind, Chief, I'm going to go next.
Sure.
And I am in the new mobile command, slowly setting up. Things are probably going to change between the next 20 episodes, depending on how long it takes me to get the whole going. But thanks to everybody who sent well wishes in recovering from the home fire. We're back at home. And we are thriving and surviving. So thank you. Appreciate you all. Special thanks to Chad and Jenny Martin for this vintage. I couldn't figure out what year this Godzilla, and it had to be from the 80s. And, you know, it's not the you know, official Godzilla, but this to me is one of those, like, you have to have one in your collection if you're a Godzilla fan. And I did not. And now, thanks to Chad and Jenny, I do. I also have, this was a rare find. I saw this online and I'm like, oh, somebody, you know, must have done a crop, you know, creation AI. It is the Squiddly Diddly. Let me see if I can get the reflection. For those of you on Facebook, Squiddly Diddly Surfing Surfari. See, if I do this, you see Bob and Karen in podcast land. But so I'm kinda, yeah, but anyway, this is cool. It's framed and we'll eventually go up back there.
Now, did you guess get
the Squiddly Diddly Surfing Safari? Was that what it is?
Squiddly Diddly Surfing Safari. Good luck finding it on eBay because I've been looking. And it finally came up maybe a couple months ago.
Now, like surf guitar stuff or what?
Surf guitar stuff.
Yeah, cool.
And, you know, apparently they had a Yogi Bear album. I'm not sure what kind of music was on that. They had a secret squirrel album. But
did you get the album with that or is that just the cover?
The album. I've listened to some songs they posted online. I haven't listened to the whole album, but at my cousin's house in San Jose is my digital record player where I can record records into my computer. And at that point, I'll burn and send you a copy.
Well,
very cool.
Last thing to share. Cue the Mandalorian theme song. This bad boy nurse is I'm gonna ask Jeff if he could paint it to look like the actual
gun. You want to tell people what it is?
That's right, for those not on YouTube, it's the Nerf version of the Mandalorian's rifle that disintegrates. I don't know what it's called on the show, but it disintegrates people, and it's freaking huge and just awesome. Highly recommend you get one if you can find one and display it proudly as yours truly does in the Planet 8 mobile command.
There you go.
And that's it for me. Bob.
Well, rather than show like half a dozen different things, I figured I'd stick with one. And but this one is very cool. And this is something that if you're not on the YouTube version,
go on it now.
You're going to want to jump over there right now. This is the X plus 30 centimeter Shin Godzilla. If you're looking at it, you can see that it's in various shades of brown and purple and what have you. But the coolest thing about it is not only does it light up, now I could light it up just boom, the whole thing's lit up. Or the cooler thing would be go the other mode. You switch to switch, the fins on his back light up, and then the light travels up his tail all the way to the tip. Look at that.
That's pretty cool.
That is cool.
And of course, his neck has some couple parts that light up, and the inside of the mouth also lights up. So very cool. Of course, got that from Kevin D'Antonio. So that was my very cool thing to share this time around.
Very nice.
I have gotten some things like maybe I'll show them in the future. J-Town Pizza in San Jose has Godzilla and Mechagodzilla pizza boxes, which look pretty cool. And I'm also just starting to get the Godzilla X Kong popcorn buckets and plushies and what have you, cups and figures. So maybe I'll do a little Godzilla Kong presentation with all the theater stuff that's coming out.
There you go.
Maybe next episode.
Well, just no Dune buckets. I want to keep this show PG-13.
It's a regular popcorn bucket. There's no phallic symbols on the top of it.
That reminds me of the Debbie Does Dallas bucket they gave out back in the 70s. Oh, sorry, I shouldn't have went there.
Is that the one with just a hole cut in the bottom? Sorry, was that too much?
It's late. What we were talking before, Walker saw Dune 1 and 2. And what would you do you recommend viewers to watch the films, or
it just depends on people's tastes. I know neither of you will be seeing Dune 2. I like I said before we started recording, I read the first two books. I wasn't a huge fan of the books because I didn't feel like I could connect on an emotional level with any of the characters. But I enjoy the films because they're visually spectacular. I do enjoy sort of the scope of the stories that they're telling. Still not particularly involved with the characters, but I find it very interesting. So if like big expansive sci-fi that's very visual is your thing, I think you'll enjoy those films.
Fair enough.
So yeah, that's what I would say.
Bob, have you seen anything recently?
We started dabbling into Pennyworth.
Oh, I saw some of those episodes. Yeah.
It's, spy intrigue type stuff, but it's basically Alfred before he becomes the Wayne Butler and his previous life. And then, first four episodes of Walking Dead, Those Who Survive, The Return of Rick and Michonne. Very good. In fact, we just watched the fourth episode and it said two episodes left. I'm like, what? It's over already? Come on.
Let's do six or eight episodes now.
But
that's cool. I'm finishing up the...
What's that? We are still watching Masters of the Air, which... I think that's around episode 7 or 8 right now of 10. So that's coming to a conclusion. But very impressive with just all the shots of all the old World War II planes and the battles in the skies and everything else. And
interesting.
Very cool.
That's cool. I'm finishing up the Bad Batch. I think I'm on halfway through episode 6. And so things are coming to a crescendo. Ooh. This is the final season, so this is going to be it. We'll see what happens with Omega. Looking forward to seeing Ghostbusters with our friend Jeff. That'll be Saturday. Star Wars Acolyte. I wasn't really interested, but the most recent trailer really grabbed my attention, and happens 100 years before episode 1 about. So maybe we'll see a younger version of Yaddle or Yoda or Master Plo Koon. We'll see, but looking forward to that.
I haven't even looked into that. Was that a series or a?
It's going to be a series on Disney. Yeah,
gonna be. So yeah,
Go ahead, Walker.
Oh, I was just wondering if either of you watched Shogun.
I watched first episode, and was so far.
Yeah, I've been enjoying. I loved the original Shogun back in, like, I don't know what, 1980, something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was skeptical, but it's been pretty good. I think I'm up to whatever the latest episode is, so 4 or 5. But you got to focus because it's all in Japanese, pretty much. And you got to read all the subtitles because you will miss. There's a lot of political backstabbing and stuff going on. You really got to pay attention.
Speaking of Japanese subtitles, I'm not an Oscar watcher. I'm not a big, you know.
I watched it.
You what?
I watched it.
Yeah, I didn't watch it. I never watch it. But it was a good thing that nice thing that Robert Downey Jr. got his first Oscar for Oppenheimer. And Japanese subtitles, Walker, Godzilla Minus One won an Oscar.
Mm-hmm. Best special effects. Vindication for us lifelong Godzilla fans that had to hear all the comments about, oh, the paper mache buildings and the rubber suits and whatever. It's like, okay. Well, this particular Godzilla movie, it beat out what? Mission Impossible and Guardians of the Galaxy 3 and Oppenheimer and all these other films. No. Godzilla. Minus one.
Cinderella story, if ever there was one.
You feel vindicated?
I am. Hey. I'm totally vindicated. I was like,
oh no.
I was home by myself. I don't remember why. But, oh no, that's right, because, yeah. Anyway, I was home by myself. So I was able to, like, dance around and be all happy. Little jig and
cartwheels in my boxers. look, to be fair, I haven't enjoyed every single Godzilla movie, Godzilla SOS.
I love Godzilla SOS.
Yeah, Chad, I was talking with Chad, and he's like, oh, American Godzilla. And hey, you know what? My philosophy is you like what you like, support it, believe in it, enjoy Dune Part 2. That's, you know, talking to the man who loves Batman v Superman. So, but Godzilla Minus One, I've seen that movie like 4 or 5 times. We saw the minus color version of it. Just a wonderful film. I mean, you could take Godzilla out of the story and it would still be a good movie. You know, he plays a big part, but still, it was good. It was congratulations to the director and the special effects team. Well earned.
We were talking about, like, all the movies and the credits and the, you know, a dozen studios with 50 people, 60 people in every studio doing stuff. Yeah, Godzilla Minus One, 35 people.
Yeah.
In the effects crew.
Yeah.
The entire movie.
Definitely. So, again, it was great. We're out of gas. This is the end of this episode.
Well, I got more gas. Let's keep going.
Thank you guys again for sharing this time with us, for giving us a listen, giving us a watch. Be sure to, our numbers are climbing. More and more subscribers every day. When we get to 1,000 subscribers, we can do live podcasting. So we can go to events and we can have guests and have a nice big online party. So look, thank you all for tuning in. Take care of yourselves. Stay safe. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. Like, comment, and subscribe. Stay safe. This is your mission commander, Planet 8, signing off. Peace out.
On that note, this will conclude this transmission from Planet 8. We would like to thank all of our intergalactic audience for listening. Be sure to head on over to our website at www.planet8podcast.com, where you can get more information on this episode's topic.
For more conversation, find us on Twitter at Planet8Cast.
Or on Facebook at facebook.com/Planet8Podcast.
We want to thank you guys for tuning in each and every episode. We look forward to your input and opinions. Until next time, this is Planet 8 signing off. End transmission.
By George, he's got it. It is the end.